headlines. Iran condemns the silence of world bodies towards Israeli crimes against Palestinians. The Arab League adopts a resolution to re-admit Syria. And officials in the Democratic Republic of the Congo say the death toll from the recent floods is nearing 400. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran has strongly condemned the silence of so-called advocates of human rights in the face of Israel's daily killing of Palestinian people. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the assassination and massacre of Palestinian activists and ordinary people is now the order of the day for Zionists. He emphasized that international organizations, particularly the UN Security Council, are legally responsible for supporting the Palestinian nation in the face of the occupying regime. Iran's reaction came just a day after three Palestinian youths were killed by Israeli forces and settlers across the occupied territories. The regime has ramped up attacks on Palestinian towns and cities in recent months. More than 110 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank alone since the beginning of this year. Iran has lashed out at European countries for their criticism of the execution of a ringleader of a terrorist group in the country. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said such a stance is aimed at meddling in Iran's judicial affairs as well as promoting and encouraging terrorism around the globe. He further said that some European governments support terrorists instead of fighting against them who put the lives of innocent people at danger. He said this reacting to the condemnations over the execution of Habib Farajullah Chaab from the European Union and some of its members, including Sweden. Chaab, nicknamed Habib Osaywid, was the leader of the Harakat al-Nidal. He had masterminded several terrorist attacks in Iran, including the one on a military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz back in 2018. Dozens of people were killed or wounded in that attack. The Arab League has adopted a resolution to readmit Syria after nearly 12 years of its suspension, consolidating a regional push to normalize relations with Damascus. The decision was made at a meeting of Arab League foreign ministers in Cairo. Secretary General of the Pan-Arab Bloc, Ahmed Abu Ghraib, even asked the Syrian President, Bashar al-Assad, to take part in the summit if he wanted to. Damascus has reacted to the decision, calling on Arab states to show mutual respect. The statement of the Syrian Foreign Ministry says that this is an important joint work and dialogue, and they have to do so to deal with challenges facing the Arab world. Syria's membership to the Arab League was suspended in November 2011 after the conflict and foreign-backed militancy gripped the country aimed at toppling the democratically elected government of President Bashar al-Assad. The death toll from a recent flood and landslides in the east of the Democratic Republic of the Congo has risen to nearly 400. Heavy rainfall in the Kalehe region on Thursday caused rivers to overflow, inundating several villages. Many houses were washed away and crop fields were devastated. Local authorities say they have sent boats filled with supplies and medicine for the survivors. The government has declared Monday as a national day of mourning. The disaster came just 2 days after the floods killed at least scores of people and destroyed thousands of homes in neighboring Rwanda. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has offered his condolences to the families of the victims in both countries. He blamed the tragic event on negligence to global warming. The Democratic Republic of the Congo is among the poorest countries in the world, riddled by corruption and conflict in the East. The Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida is in South Korea in an official invitation of President Yoon Suk-yeol. This is the first visit by a Japanese leader since 2011. This comes as anti-Japan sentiments are running high in South Korea over historical and territorial disputes. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida became the first Japanese leader to visit South Korea for a bilateral summit after 12 years. Despite ongoing historical disputes, President Yoon has reached out to Tokyo with plans to possibly include Japan in its alliance with the U.S.
Washington.
Both countries are exposed to North Korea's nuclear threats, and the military cooperation is needed more than ever. The Washington Declaration at the moment is an agreement between South Korea and the U.S., but we do not rule out the possibility of Japan's participation.
Japanese Prime Minister Kishida sought to reassure South Koreans over the impending release of contaminated water from the 2011 nuclear disaster. He also welcomed the opportunity for Japan to participate in a network of military alliances.
North Korea continues to carry out provocations in the region, and there is a sign that there is an attempt to change the current status by force. Based on this assessment, we agreed we have to strengthen deterrence and ability to respond to threats through Japanese-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-Japanese alliance, and the trilateral alliance.
Both supporters and detractors rallied outside the presidential compound. Many opposed President Yoon's outreach to Japan and militaristic pro-U.S. policies and questioned his patriotism.
Is President Yoon Suk-yeol, who is driving the Korean Peninsula towards Cold War confrontation while taking the lead in representing the interests of the United States and Japan, is he really the president of South Korea?
South Koreans have also been critical of President Yoon for creating a South Korean foundation to compensate victims of Japan's colonial rule. Improved relations between South Korea and Japan will no doubt be welcomed by the U.S., which wants to see a strengthened trilateral military alliance. And despite domestic opposition, President Yoon seems fully committed, with the largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises slated to start later this month. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The UK's anti-monarchists have criticized the heavy-handed policing of King Charles III's coronation. They say there is no longer a right to peaceful protests in Britain after dozens of protesters were arrested and detained into the night. The detainees included Graham Smith, who leads the anti-monarchy group known as the Republic. In a statement, Smith said that his arrest was predetermined and would have occurred regardless of any evidence or action. He added that the arrests were not about protecting people from harm, but about protecting the king from embarrassment. London's Metropolitan Police said a total of 64 arrests were made during the Coronation Day protests. The detainees' charges include breach of peace and conspiracy to cause a public nuisance. Ukraine and Russia have launched new drone strikes deep into each other's territories. We discuss this deadly conflict in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review. Stay tuned. Well, there seems to be no end in sight for the war in Ukraine as Kiev and Moscow are launching new drone attacks against one another. The cities of Sevastopol and Sakhy in Crimea were targeted by 10 drone strikes. Russian defense minister says it's destroyed 22 Ukrainian drones over the Black Sea. Russia has several air bases in the area, but local officials saying there was no damage. Over the past week, at least five Russian fuel facilities close to Ukraine's borders and in Crimea have come under similar attacks, and two more drones crashed on the Kremlin floor. That's Kremlin roof. Meantime, Russia has also launched widespread drone strikes on Ukraine. including on capital Kiev. Ukraine officials say that 2/3 of the country were targeted. Okay, now let me invite a couple of guests and discuss this a bit. So Glenn Diesen is professor of political science with the University of Southeastern Norway, joining me from Oslo. Also with me is Esha Krishnaswamy. She's a journalist and podcaster in St. Petersburg. Good to see you both. So beginning with the Glenn in Oslo, do you have any idea, first question to begin, how things changed because soldiers were fighting, Wagner Group on part of Russia, others Russian troops, Ukrainians, missiles were used, guns were used. Now we have the war of drones by both sides. What's changed?
Well, I guess both sides are adapting to the nature of the warfare, and especially Russia has noticed, it can, with relatively cheap drones, strike a lot of important and expensive weapon systems, especially the air defense hardware which Ukraine has been stationing. So it's proving to be an ideal weapon. And furthermore, I think that this timing is quite important as well, because they're not just hitting military targets. They're also trying to hit both sides deep behind enemy lines, mm-hmm. in terms of striking anything of arms, but also fuel depots. Because in a war like this, it's largely a war of logistics as well. Who can be able to deliver ammunition and fuel so the troops can perform optimally on the front line? So as both sides are preparing a huge offensive, at least seemingly so, I think that both sides have an incentive to use more drones at the moment to mm-hmm. to try to strike and disrupt some of the logistics which the other side will depend on in order to have a successful offensive.
Okay. And Eshap, given the circumstances, what's your anticipation? Where is this conflict, or maybe proxy war, as many call it, where is this heading for?
I think it is heading for more intensification, and it's because Ukraine, in the area known as the Bakhmut area, there is two or three supply lines that lead both to Lugansk and Donetsk, which are the mainly disputed territories between Ukraine and Russia. And as Ukraine gets pushed farther west in the Bakhmut area, they need to be able to hit the logistics like fuel depots in Russia, and that's why you've seen more aggression. And on top of that, I sense that there is a sense of desperation because the ground war is not going as well as Ukraine thought earlier this year in January, and it's gone on for much longer. And they're losing a significant position in the Bakhmut area, which is very critical for the war efforts, if you look at it from the Ukrainian side. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I sense an increased desperation and more aggression from the side of Ukraine. And maybe it is also to further draw the West into the war, to make this into not just a proxy war, but a real war between the West and Russia.
I see. Okay, Glenn, when two countries are at war, you know, other people, no matter if they're far or close, especially the closer ones, the natural thing for them to do is to, intervene and try to stop the war. But this is not happening. Russia is just pouring in more and more military aid, the U.S. from the other side. And, the European countries are sending their weaponry to Ukraine. And that at a time of economic hardship, lots of protest rallies, held in different European capital cities and other cities, they have cost of living crisis, they have all economic issues, yet they are helping Ukraine with all weaponry to the best of their ability. So why not talk of any negotiations? That's a natural thing to do.
Well, before, it used to be controversial, at least here in the West, to talk about a proxy war. It was argued that this was Russian propaganda, but obviously now the American leadership, the political leadership, the military leaders, they're all very openly talking about this as a proxy war, so I don't think there's any need to hide that aspect anymore. But avoiding peace agreement has been something quite repetitive, because after Western governments helped to topple the government in Ukraine in 2014, a very predictable civil war with Russian support broke out. But then we had a peace agreement in 2015. But as we've learned now by the admission of the Germans and the French who helped to negotiate this, as well as the Ukrainians, there was never any real attempt to implement this. And then after these 7 years of sabotaging the Minsk agreement, there was also Ukraine and Russia was apparently also close to an agreement immediately after Russia invaded. However, as we learned as well, the British, supported by the Americans, also sabotaged this peace. And now we've seen this war been going on for a whole year. Not a single Western country has stepped up to ask for negotiation, even simple negotiations, such as offering to stop NATO expansion. And there's been nothing. Indeed, when China came with a proposal, the Americans rejected it before even having a proper look at it. So,
right. So
it's quite obvious, I think, that this is, as many American leaders, both politician and military leaders, have said, this is an opportune position for the Americans. This is an opportunity to kill Russians and weaken Russia as a strategic adversary, not even using their own troops. They get to fight with Ukrainians. That doesn't mean that Ukraine doesn't have its legitimate grievances and or they're not defending themselves. It just means that the United States, in their own words, are pursuing some very specific objectives, which is in American interest, and using Ukraine towards that end is in the American interest. So so I think it's quite predictable that there's little interest by the Americans, therefore, to try to pursue a peace agreement. And the Europeans, are more or less blindly following the Americans. I think that if this offensive by the Ukrainians would fail and the Russian would be successful, thus resulting in a loss of territory, I think that would create an incentive, though, for the United States to perhaps sit down if they see that the region is shifting.
Okay, appreciate your comments. Glenn Deason, Oslo, and Esha Krishnaswamy in St. Petersburg. Thank you, and that's it for this edition of the News Review.
At least 7 people have been killed and several others injured after an SUV plowed into pedestrians in the U.S. city of Brownsville in Texas. Police say the male driver of the car is now in custody. He is charged with reckless driving that could face additional charges. The victims, who included migrants, were waiting at a bus stop near a shelter for the homeless when the crash happened. It is not clear whether the driver crashed into the group intentionally or lost control of the vehicle. Investigations are currently underway into the crash. The city of Brownsville, on the border with Mexico, is expecting an influx of migrants after the COVID-era restrictions expire on Thursday. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Moscow will reportedly begin buying foreign currency as early as this month, May, to bolster reserves. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, Russia could restart purchases of foreign currency for its reserves in May as growing energy revenues stabilize public finances despite Western efforts to damage the country's economy, Bloomberg reported recently. The finance ministry is due to announce the resumption of foreign exchange purchases later this week, the outlet said. Initial volumes are expected to be equivalent to about $200 million in yuan per month. The Chinese currency is viewed as the main asset Russia can use for transactions to refill its $154 billion, the National Wealth Fund. It will be important for the market that the state is starting to accumulate reserves again instead of spending them, said Natalia Milchakova, an analyst at Freedom Holding Corp, adding this may even positively affect the ruble. Russia halted foreign exchange purchases in late January 2022 and further suspended the program following the outbreak of the conflict in Ukraine. At the beginning of this year, the Bank of Russia resumed operations with foreign currency amid soaring oil and gas revenues. The move was part of a revamped budgetary mechanism designed to shield the economy from volatility of commodity markets, and transactions are now carried out in yuan. Moscow has slashed yuan sales over the past 2 months to cover the budget deficit, with sales halving in April compared to February. The volumes of foreign exchange purchases will initially be small but will still be highly symbolic, as they will show that Russia is building reserves rather than eating through them, according to Bloomberg's Russia economist Alexander Isakov. The shift from selling to buying would highlight Russia's ability to keep up the flow of petrodollars in the face of sanctions and the price cap imposed by the EU, G7 and their allies, Bloomberg said. Despite an unprecedented deficit which amounted to 2.4 trillion rubles, by the end of the first quarter, the Russian federal budget is on the mend, partly due to changes in the calculations of some oil taxes, Bloomberg reported. Also, Business Insider reported Russia is likely to start buying foreign currency as soon as this month, marking the first time Moscow has replenished the country's reserves since the start of Russia-Ukraine crisis in February 2022. Moscow is likely to snap up around $200 million in Chinese yuan each month, Bloomberg Economics reported recently. The yuan is one of the few key currencies available to Russia after Western sanctions cut the country off from the world's dollar-denominated financial system. Russia stopped buying foreign currency in late January 2022 due to market volatility shortly before the start of Russia-Ukraine crisis. After the crisis, Russia was hit with sweeping Western sanctions and it suspended its currency intervention program. By June, a U.S.-backed global task force had blocked over $300 billion worth of assets held by Russia's central bank. Russia resumed its currency intervention program again in January 2023, starting with the yuan. Russia's impending purchase of the Chinese currency would mark a reversal of its yuan sales from its reserves to cover its budget deficit, which hit $29 billion in the first quarter of 2023, the country has been cutting yuan sales since February, per Bloomberg Economics. Alexander Isakov, Russia economist at Bloomberg Economics, said the volumes of FX purchases will be small initially, but highly symbolic as they will show that the country, instead of eating through reserves, is building them. Moscow's resumption of foreign currency reserve interventions would indicate that Western sanctions and a G7-led price cap on Russian crude aren't enough to curb Russia's energy revenues. Russia, an energy giant, has managed to maintain its energy revenues even in the face of Western regime sanctions. In large part, the Kremlin has accomplished this by forcing oil producers like Gazprom and Lukoil to pay more taxes, Bloomberg reported. Russia has also been able to counter Western-led restrictions by redirecting oil exports to alternative markets such as China and India. The two Asian countries have been snapping up so much Russian crude that Russia's first quarter seaborne crude exports surpassed levels in the same period last year, according to Kepler, a commodities analytics firm. In April, the International Energy Agency said Moscow's revenue was down about 43% from a year ago, but oil prices have been getting support since early April due to production cuts from OPEC and Russia. On the demand side, China's economic reopening after nearly 3 years of an on-off COVID-19 lockdowns is also expected to give support to prices. U.S. crude oil futures are down 5.8% so far this year to around 76% a barrel, but are up nearly 14% from this year's low of around $67 a barrel. International Brent oil futures are down 7.6% so far this year at around $79.50 a barrel, but are up 9% from this year's low.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us present you a brief but bright gem of an advice from the Holy Prophet's 10th infallible heir, Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi, peace be upon him. The life of this world is a market in which some people gain and others lose.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, where does the tiredness of the body come from? In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure, immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salamun alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you as my listener. In this topic, in this session, we are going to understand where the tiredness of the body comes from. Probably some may feel a sluggish and tiredness, but they do not know how to restore their vigor and energy. And we are here to study the physical factors and also the psychological one. So going through the first factor, which is the bodily factor, so we know them as the physical factor. The treatments of these conditions are done by a doctor and the recovery is from Allah, the Almighty, inshallah. But the second is the psychological factor. Many of these feelings of tiredness and sluggish comes from psychological factors. But actually, we do not have any problem in our body, but we have problem in our mind. So that's why we know them as psychological factor. It includes many things. For example, such as fear of a future. Fearing a future can make us feel sluggish and tired, or worry, or shocks of the wars, or traffic accidents, or big financial losses, or being insulted before others, or thinking of previous failures, and thinking of high ambition while worrying about our actual inability. All these factors makes us feel tired, and this tiredness comes from a feeling of hopeless in our heart. So it's very important to know the ways of healing this kind of feeling in our heart. And the next part, we are going to study together some of the ways of healing this kind of feeling in our heart in order to get rid of this tiredness, this psychological tiredness. Welcome back, my dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z on IRIB English Radio. I'm Farhad, your host, and we were in the previous part, we were talking about the psychological factor of feeling tiredness and hopelessness in our heart. And we can sum up them. But here in this topic, as I promised, we're going to study the most important way of healing and curing this kind of feeling and curing our heart. We mentioned that this kind of feeling comes from the mistakes of a man himself. So the cure is obtained by repenting and asking Allah for pardon and forgiveness. It would be better to start repenting and asking for pardon and forgiveness of Allah. It would be better for one to give people's right back to them so that his conscience becomes revealed. Besides that, he must organize his time according to the religious obligations and activities of life. Here I draw your attention to an important point, and that is if you want to know the cause of your fatigue, whether it's physical or psychological, say if it disappears or lessens after sleeping or if it continues. If the first case holds, most of the cases of your fatigue is physical. And if it is the second, most of the cause is psychological. So in this case, if a man watches himself well, he will know from what he suffers, whether physical or psychological problems. And if there are psychological problems, by having a very great hope in our heart and by relying on God and his faith, we can overcome all of these difficulties, and we should know that we are able to compass it to pass, and Allah the Almighty will help us. With this hope, we can overcome all the difficulties and make the hope revive in our heart.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
First days of January. Part 2.
The beginning of the year in early January, these days always have a special feeling for me. I was born 22 years ago in such days in a village in the province of Aleppo. I've always had these feelings in me in early January. Perhaps none of my friends, relatives, or even I thought that after 12 years of my birth in this land, events would happen that would change the course of history. I am Fatemeh Ali, a student of journalism at Allame Tabatabwe University in Tehran. In my country, due to the war in Syria, I was forced to leave school and immigrate to Iran. The shy little girl in the town of Nubl, whose biggest concern was the half-hour drive away from the University of Aleppo, today writes stories for us that include hundreds of volumes of books. Today is my birthday. My friends have invited me to listen to my travelogue. Like me, they too have endured the hardships of exile and immigration. Today I was supposed to tell them the story of my 1.5 years of absence from my hometown. Four years of siege, famine, and starvation. 4 years without gas and electricity during the bone-chilling cold of northern Syria. This is only part of the suffering of the cities of Nubl and Al-Zahra. In those days, the dreams and wishes of the people depended on the fighters fighting outside the city. Those whose hearts burned like ours and did their best to not let the city fall into the hands of the Takfiri terrorists. The atmosphere in Aleppo has now returned to the days before the war. Aleppo experienced a very bitter battle and felt the heartbreak caused by the battle that killed more than 500,000 people and displaced millions. Damascus, the capital of Syria, was wounded, but it refused to collapse and give in. This city is one of the oldest cities in the world. Its inhabitants of all religions and sects lived in peace for centuries, without any war or bloodshed. But suddenly, it became face-to-face with a phenomenon called Daesh and al-Nusra. When I had to leave the country due to the war and travel to Iran, I had to travel from Aleppo to Damascus. The route was normally 4 hours. But during the war, it took 10 to 11 hours to travel. Even those armed to their teeth did not dare to cross it for fear of their lives. But what happened today is more of a miracle. It is as if the martyrs have brought eternal security for Syria. Expectations were high for the Levant, but as it is said, the road between Damascus and Mecca will see considerable security and tranquility during the time of the apocalypse. Maybe if we said something during the presence of Daesh and Takfiris in our country, no one would believe us. But today, I travel from the north to the south of Syria without any fear or worry. No one bothers me. Idlib province welcomes you. I am a member of the media and the child of Nubl. Hama welcomes you. I can stop anywhere on this route, and I can even show the situation of my country to the whole world. A country who was involuntarily entered into a world war. This neighborhood is where Syrian Jews live. This neighborhood is one of the oldest neighborhoods in Damascus. This place with the narrow alleys and short roofs. We have to tell the stories of Haj Qasim from this place, the commander who did not allow the story of the bazaar of the Levant to be repeated. Haj Qasim left his homeland and came to Syria so that the events that occurred after the Battle of Karbala in the Levant would not be repeated in the streets of Damascus. Haj Qasim broke the siege of Nubl and al-Zahra so that the sanctity of the divine sanctuary would not be violated again. This is why he was named the Master of Martyrs of the Defenders of the Shrine. Anyone who wants to know more about them should read the story of Karbala over and over again.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option.
Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. House Republicans have expanded the Biden administration's censorship probe. Republican lawmakers are investigating whether the U.S. government colluded with big tech to undermine free speech. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT reported Republican Foreign Affairs Committee members have requested access to a trove of State Department records tied to alleged coordination between the government's Global Engagement Center, GEC, interagency and social media companies to censor online misinformation and disinformation. In a recent report sent by Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Michael McCaul, to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, he, along with seven other Republican lawmakers who co-signed, states that the GEC continues to stray from its founding missions through its subsidized censorship of the free speech and disfavored opinion. It added that the committee had concerns about the GEC's current evolutionary trajectory and had asked the body to provide records and grants paid to various third-party entities. The letter, which was obtained by the Washington Examiner and published recently online, comes as part of Republican-led efforts to investigate if the federal government had manipulated social media companies to stifle free speech online. The document also argues that merely labeling speech, misinformation or disinformation does not strip away First Amendment to free speech protections. Recently, House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio, issued subpoenas to three federal agencies, including GEC, as part of his probe into big tech companies' alleged censorship. A recent release from Jordan's office stated the Twitter files and other public reporting have exposed how the federal government has pressured and colluded with big tech and other intermediaries to censor certain viewpoints in ways that undermine First Amendment principles. The Twitter files refers to internal communications between employees of the platform, the government agencies, and other third parties, which were made public earlier this year and appear to reveal unconstitutional collusion to censor undesirable narratives. The Obama-era GEC's remit, according to its government website, is to expose and counter foreign state and non-state propaganda. In September 2022, the State Department's Inspector General concluded that GEC had been adequately not vetting its methods on countering foreign threats. It also warned that it was not taking proper care when awarding grants overseas. These conclusions led to Republicans delaying a decision to reauthorize the GEC. The lawmakers said in their recent letter the GEC's legal status will ease on December 23, 2024, unless it is reauthorized as a government body. The State Department declined to comment when asked about the matter, the Washington Examiner reported. According to New York Post, House Republicans will be moving full steam ahead with investigations into President Biden and his son Hunter Biden's business dealings in Ukraine and China now that the GOP controls the chamber. The incoming chair of the House Oversight Committee recently said, "We are not investigating Hunter Biden, we are investigating Joe Biden." Representative James Comer said on NBC News Meet the Press, adding that a recent poll found 65% of Americans back a probe into Hunter Biden's laptop. "I think any American who's kept up with the political process over the past two administrations would agree we need to know what is allowable and what isn't allowable with respect to foreign adversarial intervention among family members of presidents of the United States," he continued. Comer said the Republicans' examination of Hunter Biden's laptop, first reported by the Post in October 2020, is not political. "There are emails and text messages that show Hunter Biden complaining about having to spend so much money keeping his dad up. I mean, that's a concern because Hunter Biden's only source of income was from our adversaries for influence peddling," he said. "So this is something that we should look into. This isn't political. We want to know, was the president truthful when he said he didn't have any knowledge or involvement of his family's shady business dealings? Once we have determined that, we will move on," Comer said. NBC News' Chuck Todd questioned Comer over whether the hearings into Hunter Biden would be seen by Americans as a partisan exercise. "With all due respect, Chuck, I disagree with that. I think the only people that see this as a partisan investigation are the media and the hardcore Democrats," Comer replied, adding, "At the same moment that the Democrats on the Ways and Means Committee released Donald Trump's taxes, we then moments later turned around and said Comer's investigation of the Biden family influence peddling is a revenge hearing." Despite Democrats hyping the release of Trump's tax returns as a bombshell revelation, Comer said Representative Adam Schiff overpromised and underdelivered. He said just recently that releasing Trump's tax returns was going to be a bombshell. "I mean, there is no bombshell there. There is nothing there. I've served on a bank board for over a decade. There has never been a developer. That's paid a lot of federal income tax because of desepariation and tax credits and things like that." The Post revealed Hunter Biden's network of business relationship in some countries, including Ukraine, in a series of reports beginning in October 2020. The reports were based on emails and messages on a laptop that Hunter Biden abandoned at the Washington Dell computer repair shop in April 2019. The Post reporting was censored by a number of big tech companies, including Twitter. But last month, Twitter's new CEO, Elon Musk, began releasing internal company documents known as the Twitter Files that shed light on how a small group of top executives at the social media giant decided to censor the Post scoop. Subsequent reveals by Musk showed how the FBI pressured executives at the company to remove state propaganda from the site and how Twitter officials suppressed the postings of high-profile conservatives before the 2020 presidential election.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to another edition of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we take a look at a story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective for once. Social media has become a huge part of all of our daily lives. Some of the giant brands like Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, and others boast hundreds of millions of users or more. But the social media age has as many drawbacks for Muslims as it does benefits. We'll get into that with our studio guests in just a minute. But first, we hit the streets of London this week to ask ordinary Muslims for their views as well.
I grew up on social media. I think I started in 2018. I built a following of 420,000 followers on TikTok. But I got like severely depressed because although you're kind of growing up yourself, you also grow up with other people and you feel like they have a huge impact on your life and you feel like you can't really do anything right. And I feel like having those followers did kind of influence the person that I became. Haram is very normalized, and when you do like halal things, it's not so much normalized. So it was kind of really difficult to find like the perfect balance. But when I stopped like doing certain things on social media, I lost a lot of followers. And I think on my mental health, I just kind of didn't really understand, because I thought I did something good. Obviously, I did something good like religiously, but I didn't really understand why people didn't like it. So that's what made me see social media a little bit differently. It made me realize that the people that are supporting you aren't necessarily the people you want to be supporting you. I was literally seeking validation from the creation, not the creator, astaghfirullah. But it's a blessing in disguise, alhamdulillah, because I needed that push, like, to put on my hijab.
I think it can be used for good things most of the time. It just depends on what you follow and who you interact with on social media yourself. I would say for little kids, they get influenced easily. But for me, I usually follow, for example, people that post about their jobs or they post about medicine-related stuff, etc. So it's good for me. For a lot of people, it cannot, whatever's happening in Sudan, a lot of news outlets are not maybe saying a lot of things that you can see on social media, because there's a lot of people that are in the situation themselves that are posting about, etc. But most of the time you can find misinformation, a lot of misinformation, and then other people have to come out and say, okay, this is not true. I think it's good, because a lot of the times I did not hear about Palestine, etc., what's happening on, like, for example, CNN, BBC, they're not really reporting the truth about it. But on social media, especially TikTok, you keep going on and then the news keeps going, but sometimes it's hard to filter out what is right and what is wrong.
Someone said to me, like, what is your standard of beauty? Like, what do you think beauty is? I was like, I don't know, Kim Kardashian, like, small nose, massive lips. And they were like, no, that's so wrong. And they were like to me, until you see beauty as modesty, you will never see beauty in modesty. And that night I put on the hijab. Yeah. Alhamdulillah. I used to like just do pranks on my parents, and then I gained like 100k in one day because the prank went viral, got like 4 million views. But back in 2019, it was a lot more easier to gain like traction on social media.